you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. Today's show is called A Christmas Murder by Kevin Valbenesi. Kevin's a fantastic podcaster. He does it professionally, and if you have a business, consider hiring Kevin to build you a podcast. You can find him at baroquemedia.com. A shout out to our latest patrons, John Kraft and Zachary Zeitgart. You guys rock. Thanks so much for signing up, and thank you to everyone in Patreon who left a comment. Patreon is how we're building the Twilight Histories, and it's thanks to our patrons that we're able to bring on fantastic podcasters like Kevin. Let's keep it growing. And now for today's show, A Christmas Murder by Kevin Valbenesi.
The charm of a city under a freshly laid blanket of snow is second only to that of paved streets after the rain. London is no different. This Caput Mundi has everything it needs to be considered a worthy successor to Rome. Beautiful stone facades surround you on either side of the street, and up ahead, you're greeted by the great columns of the British Museum, heaving up the roof in its central frieze to the heavens. Soldiers in immaculate uniforms patrol up and down the street astride white horses while porters mill about, garnishing street lamps with wreaths, garlands, and ornate ribbons. The entire city is decked out for a Christmas unlike any ever celebrated before. This work almost makes you think that the British are expecting the second coming of Christ. Just outside of the museum, you find a man doing his best to push the daily paper.
Daily Telegraph? Get your telegraph here.
You hand the man a halfpenny and tuck the paper under your arm as you enter the museum. Inside, you stroll through corridors lined with the spoils and splendors of a globe under British hegemony. There are sumptuous statues from the Hellenistic Age in one corridor, the striking visages of African tribal masks in another. And, turning down another hall, you find yourself in the company of the Baroque masters. It is as if the entire history of the world has been crammed under this institution's titanic roof. You find a seat and sit down in front of a massive painting stretching some 20 feet wide. The scene is one from the Heroic Age, showing a Greek king in his bath, smothered under a heavy cloth as his half-naked wife drives a dagger into his torso. The whole thing is painted with the greatest sense of melodrama, the scene unfolding in the oily yellow glow of Mycenaean lamps. As you marvel at the painting, a man in a great wool coat and bowler hat sits down next to you. The fellow is big, burly, his face like that of a bulldog, save for his mustache, which twirls out to a point at either end. He takes his hat off and lays it in his lap, marveling for a moment at the painting before him. This is Mr. Kent, your senior officer in the SIS.
A recent addition to the collection, if I'm not mistaken.
Mr. Kent raises a pair of wire-framed glasses to his eyes.
Yes. It has been attributed to a painter in the school of Rembrandt. It depicts the death of Agamemnon at the hands of his wife, Clytemnestra.
Is that right?
Oh, yes. It's a marvelous meditation on the fragility of empire. That man had just come home from the conquest of famed Ilion, outliving even great Achilles. But after so hard-fought a war and so total a victory, his kingdom fell to pieces, and with it, the heroic age of Greece came to an end.
That's a lot to deduce from one painting.
Someone labored over this for hours. They wouldn't have done so just for any mundane subject. Perhaps this painter, living in the wealthy Dutch provinces, saw the hubris of his people and felt compelled to convey this message.
Or maybe he just had a wealthy patron with a penchant for Greek mythology. The man scowls, waves a hand in front of him, dismissing your entire line of thought. Glancing over, he notices your newspaper and the image on the front page.
May I?
You oblige him. Mr. Kent spreads the paper out and lifts it up to get a better look at it. Smack dab at the top is a headline reading, "Kaiser Bill dodges close shot." There's an accompanying illustration of a man in an ill-fitting suit firing a pistol as the Kaiser dives behind a small band of German soldiers for protection.
They nearly got him this time.
Yes. What's that now? The second attempt?
Oh, yes. And he's in good company, too. The Austrian Archduke and the Russian Tsar have had their fair share of assassination attempts. I hear that even Poincaré rarely leaves his office now for fear of catching a bullet. It's a marvel any of them have agreed to come to London.
Indeed.
Speaking of which, I've received orders to do a little tidying up before our esteemed guests arrive. Lend me a hand, would you?
You set the newspaper aside and stand up, straightening out your coat and stretching out your muscles. I can spare a few minutes, sure. You thrust the heel of your boot against a door, tearing it off its hinges and sending it flying into the hallway, which is now open to you. Leveling your pistol, you advance into the hallway. A man in a thick sweater and torn trousers steps out into the hall and turns white when he fixes his eyes on you. The man reaches for his pocket, but before he can fish anything out, you unload two shots into his chest. He collapses to the ground with a thud. Not a moment later, two more men, dressed like their fallen comrade, come around the corner. But seeing your pistol, they dive back as you unload two more rounds into the wall nearby. Behind you, two men in trench coats charge in, pistols at the ready. They rush forward and, finding a better angle on the next corridor, they lay down covering fire. You rush out under the cover of your allies and clip both of your adversaries, one in the leg and the other in the shoulder. They drop their weapons and hold up their arms in surrender. You kick away the enemy's pistols and then signal for the two men in trench coats to secure them. Taking a moment to reload, you then press yourself against the wall, ready to round another corner. You listen and hear footsteps in the next room. Sprinting out from around the corner, you find a man halfway out of a window. You level your pistol at him and call out, "Stop, or I'll drop you dead." The man does as he's told. "Now, turn around. Slowly." The man complies. You get a good look at him. The fellow is dressed in a cheap wool suit, his white shirt collar stained brown with dirt and sweat. He has a large, thick beard, and if he was a little older, you'd take him as the spitting image of Karl Marx. "Hands where I can see them. Come on." Again, the man complies.
"We've done nothing wrong,"
he says with a thick Russian accent. "Your men shot at me."
"Because you shot first. You kicked down our door."
"Fair point." You glance around the room, keeping the pistol leveled at the man's chest. You can see pamphlets, books, and bullets spread out on worn desks.
"We don't want any trouble."
Nobody who really means that owns a gun. Also a fair point. The man nods, terrified, but at least not beyond reason. He keeps his hands high, palms open, looks you straight in the eye. "Now, you're going to tell me what you're doing here."
Yes, sir.
The man's eyes go wide and he looks past you, just over your shoulder.
"Mo, wait, you don't understand.
The man gesticulates, and an instant later, a bullet rips into his shoulder, the impact sending him crumpling back. He spills out over the windowsill and plummets two stories, presumably to his death. You spin around, gun first, but you quickly lower it upon seeing Mr. Kent, his own pistol in hand, still smoking for the last shot. I had him.
Preposterous. You let your guard down.
The old man strolls around the room, picking up the pamphlets.
Socialists. They multiply faster than rats. And the particular plague they carry demands preemptive treatment.
More men in trench coats come into the room and begin to gather up everything not nailed down. You stride over to the window and stick your head out. Looking down, you see the bearded Russian man laying in the snow below, his arms and legs spread out like a morbid snow angel, with a peppering of red emanating from the base of his skull. Mr. Kent barks orders to his agents.
Don't leave even a single leaf of paper behind. I'm going to speak to the Tsar's man. Give him an early Christmas present.
He leans out of the window next to you, shaking his head at the mangled body laying out there.
Oh, and someone clean up this mess out here.
You sit in a small parlor at the back of a gentleman's clothiers. A fresh cup of tea sits on a silver tray, giving off a dense stream of steam. A manservant in a crisp white shirt and a silk waistcoat drops down two cubes of sugar into your cup and stirs it without ever once hitting the porcelain walls of the interior. You thank the man as he exits the room, leaving you alone with your reflection and several wall-mounted mirrors. Across the room, there's the beginnings of a bespoke suit resting on a mannequin. You see the intricate chalk marks and pins set into the fabric. You sip your tea and cross the room to get a closer look at this garment. It's much more relaxed than the tight tweed jacket you're wearing, and it has none of the nicks, tears, and patches that come with your sort of work. That's for the best, you think. Perhaps after this whole Christmas bash, you'll be able to settle down and enjoy the finer things on offer in a London free from the burdens of global war. The manservant returns with company. You were expecting the tailor, but instead, you find your grizzled commander standing there. You nod to him and thank the manservant again as he closes the door behind him. Mr. Kent, you say with some exasperation. What can I do for you?
Quite the coincidence, no?
How's that?
Well, he says, cheery as can be, we both go to the same tailor. He really is quite the craftsman. A little nip and tuck here and there, and he can make even the portliest of men look rather fetching in a smoking jacket.
Mr. Kent pulls a cigar from his pocket and lights it with a match. He exhales, instantly filling the room with a thick, spicy smoke. You clear your throat, but he pays you no mind and takes another long pull on the cigar. You return to your seat, crossing your legs and checking your pocket watch for the time. Mr. Kent pulls up a seat next to you and plops down in it, exhaling another nimbus cloud worth of smoke. What are you here for, sir?
I'm here to pick up an order. This evening's festivities require a more refined silhouette than we usually cast.
I don't think mine will be ready in time. I wasn't aware of the stricter uniform requirements either. We're not the Royal Guard, after all. You lean back in your seat and gently waft smoke away from your face. Mr. Kent leans in, grinning with two rows of yellowing teeth.
It's all been taken care of.
Mr. Kent turns towards the door and clears his throat.
Marvin, would you please come in here? Oh, and bring the bundle, would you?
On cue, an older gentleman in fine silks enters, a tape measure draped around his shoulders and a bundle of carefully folded clothes in hand. The manservant steps in as well with a mannequin, and the two of them go about dressing the mannequin in what you come to realize is a military uniform of the most splendid craftsmanship. The jacket is a deep navy blue, almost black. The shoulders are pronounced with golden embroidered epaulets, and the cuffs are likewise embellished. The collar is high and stitched with a laurel wreath motif. Accompanying the jacket are a sturdy pair of navy trousers, simple in design and expertly tailored and hemmed. The manservant also sets down a pair of polished black leather boots in front of the mannequin. All told, the outfit looks fit for a king, not one of his humble servicemen.
Well, don't just gawk at it. Try it on.
Sir?
Consider it an early Christmas present for a job well done. You haven't been with us long, but your service has been impeccable. And to be blunt, I need you boys looking sharp this evening. We'll be in the company of Europe's finest, after all.
The manservant takes the clothes from the mannequin as quickly as he'd set them up, and pulls one of the mirrors away to reveal a changing room in which he hangs the clothes. You don't hesitate, and step inside to begin changing. Once the door is closed behind you, you fan your arms vigorously to disperse the smoke already penetrating this tight room. I'm grateful, sir, but I'm afraid I don't have anything to offer you in return.
Just do a good job tonight. We can't afford even the slightest disturbance this evening. Bloody hell, if a waiter drops his tray, he'll be riddled with bullets, courtesy of the Kaiser's jumpy bodyguards. Or maybe the Tsar's men will shoot first. Either way, this party must diffuse tension between Europe's leaders, not inflame it.
Sir, do you really think that war can be averted with dinner and a show?
Perhaps. Half the people in attendance this evening are bloody relatives. I'm sure the king and his dear cousins can settle their nation's petty disputes over some fine port. Or, being more pragmatic, perhaps the lot of them will retire and leave the governing to their people.
You don't mean that, sir. Do you? I took you for an avowed monarchist.
Oh, I do love the king as a man, but I'm glad for the golden fetters in which we bind the royal family. Look at the Kaiser. He marches around in his big boots, playing at being the next Charlemagne, threatening the whole lot of us. No, I wonder sometimes if French got it right after all.
You button up your jacket, running your fingers over the fine decorated florals etched into the buttons themselves. Looking at your reflection in the mirror in front of you, you have to admit that you cut an elegant figure, but still look every bit the professional killer you are. With a little extra panache, you step out and stand before Mr. Kent. How I'll actually see you through the thickening smoke doesn't cross your mind.
Marvelous. Simply marvelous. I look at you, and I see the future of Britannia.
Mr. Kent, about the French getting it right.
Just a flight of fancy. The world is changing so quickly that an old man wonders what will become of his king and country. That's all. We can send telegrams across vast distances, and great engines power industry where once slaves had to do work by hand. But we still live in a world where people call their leaders Caesar. How much longer will that world endure, I wonder?
Mr. Kent puts out the remaining stump of his cigar and stands up. He places his hands on your shoulders, making a show of straightening out your brand new uniform.
But that's all a matter for tomorrow. We still have tonight to attend to. I'll see you at the opera in a few hours. Don't be late.
Yes, sir. Mr. Kent steps out of the parlor. You follow him out into the shop and watch him exit the clothiers with the tip of his hat to the tailor. Turning to the counter where the clothier is measuring out strips of fabric, You pull out your wallet, but he places a firm hand on it, preventing you from paying.
No need, sir. That gentleman paid.
No, I mean for my own jacket.
He settled that order as well, sir.
You turn and look out the window at Mr. Kent. The old man pulls his coat tight around him and takes a moment to enjoy the decorations lining the street before finally taking off at a steady clip. You make arrangements for the final fitting of your jacket, and then you yourself step out into the night. The evening arrives, and with it, your call to duty. Now in the faint glow of street lamps, you see the splendor of a London embellished with the purest vision of a Yuletide paradise. Either side of Floral Street is lined with crowds of excited Londoners, festive carolers at the front holding candles and singing sweet hymns for the honored passers-by. Several large Christmas trees stand at the entrance to every side street and intersection, wrapped in twinkling silver lights and crowned with woven stars embellished with gold leaf. From the roofs above, an intricate array of wires cross from one building to the other, holding little porcelain angels and more stars, suspending them in the air. The procession of Europe's leaders is a magnificent sight itself. You stand at the corner of Floral and Bow, watching as ornate carriages drawn by Goliath white steeds advance toward you, surrounded by bristling forests of upward-turned rifles with their bayonets gleaming in the moonlight. As the first two carriages pass, you glimpse King George V seated alongside his loving wife, Queen Mary. Next, you spy Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany seated alone in his carriage, smoking a pipe. More carriages come and go, carrying the Russian Tsar, the President of France, the Prime Minister of Italy, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and several diplomats from as far abroad as Japan, Great Qing, and the Ottoman Empire. Once the bulk of the procession passes, you lead your men toward the intricate glass and metal facade of the Floral Hall. You are the last into the hall, securing the doors behind you, and immediately beginning a leisurely patrol around the interior. You try to avoid being distracted by the sumptuous scene arranged by the king's men. A large central table offers up roast pork, chicken, pheasants, sides of beef, all accompanied by giant bowls spilling over with colorful vegetables. And at either end of the table, several mountainous cakes rise up, crowned with candied apples and surrounded at their bases with balls of marzipan and chocolate. Several Greek and Roman sculptures, which you suspect were pulled from the halls of the British Museum, stand as silent witnesses to the royal spectacle at either side of the room. Garlands wind their way around the thin columns and up into the metalwork of the ceiling. Two large Christmas trees flank the doors, providing cover and a faint taste of pine to the festive atmosphere. You and your men pass a troop of Russian soldiers, all of whom have already forgotten about their emperor and are troubling the servants for another round of eggnog. The Germans, meanwhile, form a semicircle around the grumpy Kaiser, who stands alone, his withered hand tucked into his pocket and a glass of scotch raised in the other. Coming up on King George, you salute to him and his near doppelganger, Tsar Nicholas II of Russia. You find the two men sharing a laugh, glancing over at the crestfallen Kaiser. Finally, George works up the courage to approach his German cousin, passing through the ranks of German soldiers as if they were mere reeds to be parted. Nicholas hangs back for a moment, but upon seeing that the Kaiser greets the king with a nod and a tense smile, he quickly shuffles over. Could a bit of small talk spare the world a global conflagration? Can kind words between a few cousins divert three imperial powers from the course of war? Immeasurable wealth and countless hours were spent on preparing London for this very moment. The three descendants of Queen Victoria coming together in the spirit of the holidays to cast aside all thoughts of malice and mistrust. If there is to be peace, it all begins with these three men. Hours after the dignitaries have filled their bellies and gotten mirthfully drunk on the generous outflowing of eggnog, scotch, brandy, and port, everyone files over into the main opera hall upstairs, draped with red flowing carpets. You escort King George, the Kaiser, the Tsar, and their respective retinues to the front row of the opera house. And the two rows immediately behind the three monarchs fill quickly with their respective royal guards, all tripping over each other to find a seat closest to their sovereign. The rest of the main floor fills up with the other attendant dignitaries, including the lonely Austrian Archduke, President Poincaré of France, and Prime Minister Salandra of Italy. All told, there's nary a seat empty in the vast opera house. From behind the curtains, the young men of King's College Choir emerge, dressed in flowing white robes and carrying their leather-bound folios. A conductor joins them, and they make a show of preparing for the evening's performance. Once everyone is comfy, you leave your men to do a quick patrol of the exterior hall. Stepping out into the foyer of the opera, you find more of the assembled European troops relaxing out of the sight of their charges. The Russians, French, and Italians make merry at the bar while the Germans fraternize amongst themselves and with their Austrian cousins. The only soldiers here still actively on duty are the few British Royal Guards posted about the foyer. Glancing around, you take notice of one man who looks rather out of place this evening. Mr. Kent stands near a service entrance looking anything but composed. His hair is wild on his head. His white shirt collar is stained with sweat, and he spills more than he sips from a very generous glass of what you presume is whiskey. A few of the British Royal Guard regard him with shame and embarrassment, but nobody ventures to do anything about the poor older man. You cross the foyer and approach Mr. Kent, pulling up a seat next to him. "Sir, are you all right?"
"Huh? No. Yes, just trying to ease the old nerves. One mistake and it's a bloody war."
"We've got everything under control, sir. There hasn't been a peep all night."
"No, I suppose not."
You hear the first few notes of Silent Night waft out from the hall, followed by the angelic voices of the choir.
"Indeed, a silent night."
Mr. Kent guzzles the entire glass of whiskey, paying no regard to the mess he makes as much of it trickles down either side of his face.
"Listen, I'm going to get myself cleaned up. Keep up the good work."
"Can I accompany you, sir?"
"No, no, that won't be necessary."
Mr. Kent wipes his face and brow for good measure. Fumbling with his buttons, he tries to do up his coat. Then, lumbering away, he disappears behind the service door. You hang back for a moment, but concern grips you and you push through the door. Entering the dim corridor, you spot Mr. Kent rushing past the lavatory and up a flight of stairs. Confused, you pursue him, mindful not to make too much noise, lest you disturb the concertgoers and the immaculate choir. Heading up a flight of stairs, you arrive on another level, just in time to see Mr. Kent zipping up yet another flight of stairs, moving well for a man bloated with alcohol. You keep up your pursuit, growing more concerned by the moment. Up another flight of stairs, you find Mr. Kent peering out from the highest balcony in the opera. He lets his coat slip away, revealing a sweat-drenched shirt and a holstered pistol. Wiping yet more sweat from his brow, Mr. Kent draws his pistol and creeps forward toward the edge of the balcony. You immediately draw your own pistol and rush forward, still mindful of your steps. You let out the loudest whisper that you can to draw his attention.
"Sir, what are you doing?"
Mr. Kent freezes in place. He glances at you out of the corner of his eye and seems to loosen up. He turns to you, face red and eyes wild. He keeps his pistol pointed out past the balcony.
"Oh dear, why'd you have to go and spoil the moment?"
Mr. Kent inches further toward the balcony, his eyes fluttering away from you for an instant or two as he searches for his target. You pull back the hammer on your pistol, and that stops him, momentarily.
Come on now, leave an old man be.
Put down the gun.
Why? You don't even know what I'm going to do.
Whatever it is, you need to stop.
I'm going to give one last gift this evening. I'm going to send a bullet with my love into the Kaiser's skull. Or the Tsar's. Or the King's. Really, it doesn't matter. But someone needs to take it.
Mr. Kent defies your imperative and inches closer to the balcony again, squinting to better acquire his target.
I said stop. I'm your superior officer. You stand down.
This is treason.
Only to the old order. Once a king falls, there will be a war like no other. We've been trying so very hard to avoid it, but have come around to the notion that a short and purifying conflict across the continent may sweep away the very autocrats who so often lead us to arms. They will shell us, and we will shell them. And once there is nothing left but the pulverized remains of a Europe no one remembers, then perhaps we could forge a better future for ourselves.
You can't wager the fate of millions on a hunch.
Why? Those inbred Mongols we call monarchs have sent thousands to their death for far less.
Mr. Kent pulls back the hammer on his pistol. You aim at his chest, your finger on the trigger.
Well, then I'll leave the decision to you.
Mr. Kent pulls a pocket watch out and flips it open.
I will shoot in 1 minute. You have that much time to make your decision.
He refuses to meet your eyes again, instead focusing on his target. You don't know if he's trained the barrel on the Kaiser, or the King, or the Tsar, but you know the result will be the same. As time ticks away, you come to terms with the likely outcome of this fatal instance. Either one will die, or millions will. How many depends on how much pressure you apply to the trigger of your gun.
Now that I think about it, I never had much love for the Krauts anyway.
Mr. Kent adjusts his aim, and unsure of how much time is left. You take that to mean the moment has come. You fire your pistol, striking Mr. Kent in the throat. He drops his gun, grasping at his neck. You rush forward, but before you can grab him, his body crumples and collapses over the railing of the balcony, plummeting to the theater below. Reaching the balcony, you see a terrible scene unfolding, not on the stage, but down in the rows of seats. Soldiers jump over chairs and knock people out of the way as they all converge on the mangled corpse of Mr. Kent. His arms and legs bent in impossible ways, his eyes glassy and fixed on the roof. The Tsar and Kaiser run for cover with their men, but King George rushes forward, coming upon Mr. Kent. The king looks from the fallen body of his intelligence officer and up to the balcony from which he fell. Right at you. Several pistols follow the king's eyes and fix themselves on you as well. Without hesitation, you drop your gun and throw your hands up. Fully comprehending the situation, several of the audience members become hysterical and flee, including several heads of state and diplomats. Soldiers no longer needed to mind the dead man break away from their comrades and rush for the nearest stairwell, likely coming to apprehend you. It's less than a minute before you hear heavy footsteps coming up the stairs behind you. Cries in German, Russian, and English demand that you kneel. And what can you do but comply? As you do kneel down, the ledge of the balcony blocks your view of the rattled king below. As a pair of soldiers manhandle you and throw you onto your back, pointing their guns in your face, you wonder if the excitement will end here. Or if you've unwittingly given Mr. Kent the war he'd been hoping for.
Well, there you have it. A Christmas Murder by Kevin Valbenesi. I'm a big fan of another Jordan, Jordan Bonaparte from the Nighttime Podcast. He's very strict about quality. He gets it right, and as a consequence, his show does extremely well. I really admire him, so it's a pleasure today to recommend the Nighttime Podcast.
Canada may have the reputation of an overly friendly and kind of boring place. Well, it isn't. I'm Jordan, and on my show, Nighttime, I dive headfirst into the darkest, strangest, and most fascinating stories Canada has to offer. I've been joined by families of missing persons, cult leaders and their followers, experiencers of paranormal events, and hell, I've even had a guest share the bizarre details of her drug conviction, one that came about in a failed scheme to sell drugs out of a Tim Hortons drive-thru window to customers ordering non-existent 15-packs of Timbits. I hope you join me on the show. You can subscribe to Nighttime anywhere you get podcasts.
Please go over and subscribe to Nighttime. It's a fantastic podcast and one I feel proud to showcase here. One year for Christmas, my dad gave me a subscription to a history magazine. It was the best Christmas present I ever got because every month I'd get something in the mail. It was the gift that just kept giving all year round. Even in the blazing heat of summer, that Christmas gift was still pumping out the spirit. It was seriously the best gift. This Christmas, why not consider a Twilight Histories membership? It's like getting a magazine in the mail, but instead of articles, you get full, rich audio stories, just like you love. And there are tons of them. Over 40 in the backlog, and more going up as fast as I can produce them. And Kevin Valbenesi is coming on board in February with a monthly show for members. Awesome. So what a great gift. And look, if you can't rope someone else to getting it for you, why not treat yourself? It's monthly, and you can cancel any time, so there's really no risk. You can put down as little as a buck right now, and it's all gain. Go to twilighthistories.com and click on Patreon. Or just go directly to patreon.com and run a search for The Twilight Histories. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening, and take care.